Who here has seen the Mr. Bean disaster movie? It's a very retro thing. Okay, so like four, five. Five, yeah. So in the Mr. Bean disaster movie, the premise of the film is Mr. Bean is obviously the main character. He is... Rowan Atkinson often plays a range of different characters, but he literally plays Mr. Bean, the goofy, slightly alien character. And Mr. Bean has a job in the National Gallery, just being one of those stewards, you know, who sit there, just make sure that traffic is moving, that no one's behaving badly. And another premise of the film is that the British are very snooty and think they're the best. There's an American art conference going on, and none of the senior staff in the National Gallery want to go to America to this conference because they think they're all idiots. And so they decide, oh, who's the worst employee we have? And it's Bean. And so they send Mr. Bean along, masquerading as an expert. It takes the Americans an awfully long time to realize that Mr. Bean's a complete fool. And so the very first time they meet him, it's like, so what do you do, Mr. Bean? And he says, my job is to sit and look at paintings. And they're like, whoa, so profound. Not realizing that he's just talking about being a steward. So my job is to sit and look at paintings. Now, I think that just so happens to be a really good summary of how you read and apply Isaiah. It's like paintings. It's like an art gallery. And the thing you do is you just sit in front of the picture and look at it. And that is actually applying Isaiah. So application is not, what must I do? It's not, go and do something. We do want to get there, but it's about the heart change, the mind change that leads to changed actions, right? So I'm not saying you won't end up changing your behaviours, but let's not make the shortcut and just do it, because that will be very short-lived. Let's go the long way round, which is to marinate our brains in God's word. So you sit there, you take it in, you think about it, you reflect on it. I actually think that Isaiah, it will take, some of us are new to it, so it will take a while to get used to the genre. But I actually assure you that of all the genres in the Bible, so think what are the main ones, there's narrative, there's story, there's oracles or picture books, basically, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah. There's letters in the New Testament. Let's just take those three as the big ones. There are variations, but basically, if you read a story, you have to be invested in the story. You have to think about the story, and there's a sort of lesson. There's a moral of the story. So you actually have to work a bit harder to work out what the lesson is. A bit harder. With letters, if you want to enjoy the form of the text, you actually have to be able to understand complex grammar, clauses, subclauses. You have to understand author's purpose to a very high degree, really, to be able to read letters well. Now, oracles, word pictures, are the simplest. You just sit in front of it and look at it, and that's all you have to do. So if in doubt, if at any stage you're thinking, I don't really know what I'm doing with Isaiah, think Mr. Bean in the disaster movie, my job is to sit and look at paintings. Let's get into Isaiah 5. So if everyone has a handout in front of them. Today in Isaiah 5, we're going to see two different pictures, both essentially about how God feels about sin. How God feels about sin. So the first picture, 5:1-7, is a very short one. It's basically a song. It's a song about how God feels. And the answer to how he feels is exasperated. But we'll see that in detail, 5:1-7. And then over the page, 8:30, this is a really long picture, 8:30. Here's a picture of how God feels about sin. What we see is Judah's sin is enormous, vast. And so God's wrath, God's anger in return is also vast. And so we'll see that anger. We'll see what frustrates him. So today, how God feels about his people's sin. Let's then start with the first picture. So 5:1-7, this is the cuter and easier to read of the two pictures. So there's a simple logic to the song in the points on the right. So the song starts, God set up a vineyard really well. A vineyard was really well set up by God. He did everything he could for it. But it only yielded bad fruit, wild grapes. And so, 5 and 6, God, the owner, destroys it. So there's a shape to the song. And then there's an explanation in verse 7, and I've put the explanation in bold because that is the main point of the whole of 1-7. This is how God feels about his people's sin. So without verse 7, You might wonder, what's this song about? But verse 7 leaves no ambiguity. This is how God feels about his people's sin. Let's get into that. So 5 verse 1. Isaiah says, I will sing for the one I love, who is God. I will sing a song about God's vineyard. So that's the title. Here's a song about God's vineyard, the title. And then the song starts, my loved one, my beloved God, had a vineyard on a fertile hill. That's a great start. Of course, you want to start on a fertile hill. Verse 2, God dug it up and cleared it of stones. So you can imagine he tilled the soil, eliminated the stuff that would hinder growth. He planted the soil with the choicest vines. We all know that the best vines make the best wines, which is just pure poetry, that. Best vines make the best wines. Halfway through verse 2, he built a watchtower in the vineyard, and that's so that he could see any major wild animals or thieves coming in to take the fruit. And he cut out a wine press as well, because obviously he's intending to make quality wine with the quality vines. But we have a problem. Then God looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. And you're thinking, oh, very dear, all that effort, all that good setup. Verse 3, God says, now you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. It's a way of saying, take a look at what I'm dealing with. You guys, come round, witness this. Can you see what I'm seeing? Verse 4, what more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Can you sense that exasperation? He put in all that effort to set it up well, and then only for the vineyard to fail at its one job. You only had one job, vineyard. So verse 5, and just sense the ownerness of God. Now I will tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. It's very much God's vineyard. God can do what he wants with it. And then in verses 5 and 6, we have four I wills, almost like bullet points. So the first bullet, I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed, it being the vineyard. So God says, I'll take away its protective hedge, the vineyard will be destroyed. Bullet 2, I will break down its wall, and so the vineyard will be trampled. Bullet 3, verse 6, I will make it a wasteland. It will be neither pruned nor cultivated. In fact, thorns and thistles, briars and thorns will grow there. I think a deliberate echo to that frustration of Genesis 3, thorns and thistles, by the sweat of your brow, that sort of feeling. So three I wills that are very understandable. You've got a useless vineyard as an owner. What do? You destroy it. But just notice the godness of God in the final bullet of verse 6. This is a real boss move. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. What a boss. You can only get away with saying that if you are confident that indeed the clouds will not rain on it. Then we have verse 7. The song explained, the vineyard of Yahweh Almighty, the vineyard of Yahweh of armies, is the nation of Israel. The people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. So just in case we weren't sure what this vineyard song was about, clearly it's God being frustrated with his people's sin. Halfway through verse 7, God looked for justice. But instead of justice, he saw bloodshed. He saw violence. He looked for righteousness. That just means goodness. But instead, he heard cries of distress. And that's probably the distress of those being oppressed. The cries of victims. So this is how God feels about his people's sin. He is exasperated. He set them up as well as possible. They only had one job. And yet, they failed. So that's verses 1 to 7, as I said, quite a simple, quite a cute picture. Okay, over the page. So a significantly more vast picture. So think National Gallery. Not every painting in the National Gallery is equally sized. You get some quite cute, small, well-formed, very bite-sized type pictures where you can look at it, it's all there. 5'8" to 30 is one of those vast paintings in a vast frame where you almost have to look at different bits of it to be able to take in the whole. Now, the structure of this picture, if you look at the words, the Bible words, I've put in red some hints for structure. So what we have is woes and therefores, and then a repeat woes and therefores. So we have a picture of two halves. Verse 8, woe. Verse 11, woe. So you get woe, woe. And this woe means sort of curses to you or doom is coming. We're not thinking sort of Bill and Ted's Adventure. Woe, woe, dude. We're thinking kind of curses to you. So verse 8, verse 11, woe, woe. And then 13, 14, therefore, therefore. We can see that, right? In red. So that's one half of the picture. Then we see the repeat from verse 18 onwards. And we get extra woes. So woe 18, woe 20, woe 21, and woe 22. Woe, 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 woe. Therefore, therefore, 24, 25. So can we see the structure? Woes and therefores, woes and therefores. And hint, the second half gets more angry. In the first half, I've put it as point one, we have the idea of greed and consumption. Judah is greedy and wants to consume everything. And so God punishes them with a poetic justice where the theme of punishment is hunger and greed. So, oh yeah, you want greed and consumption? Well, I'll give you greed and consumption when death swallows you up. So that's the first half of this picture. There's poetic justice. Let's go on to the second half of the picture from verse 18. If you look at the points, you'll see that we start with Judah choosing sin. Judah chose vast amounts of sin. So, from verse 24, God chose devastation. And then from verse 26 onwards, over the page, God has even more devastation for Judah. So let's look at this vast portrait of Judah's sin and God's wrath. Verse 8. Woe to you, doom to you, who add house to house. Woe to those who add another house to your already large portfolio of property. Woe to you who join field to field. Think rich, greedy landowners. These opening two lines do sound out of context, a bit like Gary's Economics, don't they? But line two goes into line three. You are so greedy to add till no space is left and you live alone in the land. Can you hear the sarcasm, the sass in God's voice there? You love space so much that you take up everything and nobody can live anywhere near you because you have that much land, that much property. Well, woe to you, doom to you. Verse 9. Yahweh Almighty has declared in my Isaiah's hearing. And note the poetic justice that will follow. By poetic justice, what I mean is whatever bad people do, it gets repaid along the same lines. So these greedy people who love great houses, Yahweh says, verse 9, surely the great houses will become desolate. The fine mansions will be left without occupants. In other words, oh, you enjoy having space, do you? You want more space, and that's why you keep buying more houses and more fields. You like space? Well, I'll give you space. Your fine mansions will be empty. How's that for space? So I hope you see the poetic justice. You want space? I'll give you space, but in a bad way. Verse 10. A 10-acre vineyard, that's huge, will produce only 22 litres of wine. That's what a bath is, 22 litres-ish. That's insane. This huge vineyard will produce a tiny amount of wine. A homer of seed, that's around 160 kilos. 160 kilos of seed will only yield a tenth of grain, only about 16 kilos, an ephah of grain. So, oh yeah, you want to be greedy? Well, that greed is punished with scarcity, hunger. So again, poetic justice. That's 8, 9, and 10, the first woe. Second woe, verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning, i.e. work super hard or are super focused, to run after their drinks, to run after alcohol. So it's an ironic jarring here where you have super dedication. I'm going to get up at 5:30 a.m. because I love the gym, except instead of the gym, I'm getting up super early. The alarm goes off. I must get up because I'm so committed to get wasted. Verse 11, woe to those who stay up late at night, again, super committed, industrious, till they are inflamed with wine. So they're not working, they're not producing good, they're just getting wasted. So woe to these guys. Verse 12, they have harps and lyres at their banquets, they have pipes and tambourines and wine. Can you picture the fanciness, the excessiveness of how they party? The greed. So woe to these people who put so much effort into harps, lyres, pipes, tambourines, wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of Yahweh. They have no respect for the work of his hands. They don't look to God at all. They're just selfish, partying for themselves. And when it says the works of Yahweh's hands, the deeds of God's, there's two things probably in mind. There's, at the very least, the creatorness of God. They're not looking to their creator who made the heavens and the earth. How dare they not acknowledge him? They're probably enjoying the gifts, but not enjoying the giver, creator of those gifts. But there's another level which, if you're a Jew, should matter. What is the most famous work of God's hands? It is the Exodus. It is the establishment of Israel. It is the foundation of Israel when God rescued a bunch of slaves out of Egypt and established them in the land of Canaan as a sovereign nation, as a kingdom. So we Gentiles, so I'm guessing most of us are Gentiles, we Gentiles probably would focus more on the creatorness of God. That's the obvious work of his hands. But remember that God's talking to the Jews here. And so they have this extra work of God's hands. They don't even think about me when I rescued them. I established them as a nation. And they have these tambourines and lyres and harps, the greedy excess celebrating themselves. So you can see the sin. It's around greed and consumption. Therefore, verse 13, this is God's punishment. Therefore, my people will go into exile for their lack of understanding. Exile, and in exile, all people will be hungry and thirsty. So those of high rank will die of hunger, but not just the high rank, the common people will be parched with thirst. So doesn't matter if you're high or low, rich or poor, God wants hunger and thirst as punishment. So can you see the greed to hunger, poetic justice? And then verse 14, I'll give you greed. You want greed, I'll give you greed. Verse 14, therefore death is going to get greedy. Sheol expands its jaws, opening wide its mouth. You can picture the jaw opening of death. And then into death, into Sheol, will descend their nobles and masses. Note a burial theme, going into the ground theme. So the nobles and masses will descend with all their brawlers, that's noisy partiers, or their brawlers and revelers. So all you celebrating feasty people will be eaten up by death. You will descend into the ground. Verse 15, so people will be brought low, everyone humbled. Is there anything more humbling than being lowered into the ground as a corpse? The eyes of the arrogant will be humbled by death. And so, verse 16, Yahweh Almighty, only he will be exalted by his justice. So God sits above. He humbles the others by death. And the holy God will be proved holy by his righteous acts. One day everyone will see that God is holy. He will prove it by his actions. And so verse 12, they had no regard for God's deeds. Verse 16, God will prove his holiness through his deeds. And then 17 is a bit cryptic, but I think what's going on here is there's an order of creation. Humans are supposed to be above animals. That was the Adam and Eve mandate. But here, if you're buried in the ground, and then the picture is of sheep having a great time eating the grass above you, that's extra humiliation. Then sheep will graze as in their own pasture. So they'll eat the grass above you, your buried body, just like they would in their own field. Lambs, or strange lambs maybe, as in lambs that don't belong here, they will feed among the ruins of the rich. So extra humiliation, even animals will be above you, is the picture. So that's the first half of the picture. The sin is described as greed and consumption. The punishment is therefore described through hunger and a different form of consumption. Death consumes the sinful. Verse 18. So verse 18, this is a bigger picture, and where it's going is lots of sin, and then the judgment, verses 24 and 25, are really severe judgment, but the last two lines, yet for all of this severity, God's anger is not turned away. His striking hand of anger, of punishment, is still upraised, and then over the page, verses 26 to 30, we see even more devastation. So it is a brutal picture. Verse 18. Woe, doom to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness as with cart ropes. That's quite a lot of words, but it's actually an amazing picture. Imagine a cart, and let's call that sin. And then imagine you've got ropes for the cart, deceit or lies. God is basically saying, you guys like sin so much, it's like you're pulling a sin cart with sin ropes. So that's the picture, a sin cart with cords, ropes of lies and wickedness. So woe to you guys who love sin so much, everything you touch is sin, your ropes of sin, your cart of sin. And woe to those who say, and just picture the cheek, let God hurry. Let God hasten his work so that we may see it. The so-called plan of the Holy One of Israel. Let it approach. Let the plan come into view so that we may know it. Do you hear the brazenness of that? Go on then, God. You made promises. You're going to do stuff. Well then, do it. Let's see it. Prove you can do it. Hurry up. And the cheek of saying, the Holy One of Israel in verse 19. I don't think your attitude suggests that you really know what that word means, the Holy One of Israel. Really? If you knew how holy he was, would you dare speak to God in this way? Now, that attitude of hurry up, let's see God's work, that will cash out over the page in verse 26. So just hold it in your mind. It will cash out big time. Verse 20. Woe to those who have subverted everything. They call evil good, and they call good evil. Woe to those who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Just to illustrate total subversion and flipping, I think it always makes us angry when somebody in charge calls something that they're doing good when it's evidently bad. It just makes everyone's blood boil. But the illustration I can't get out of my mind is in the Paris Olympics, people celebrated watching two men beat up women and smash their way to gold medals. And this was a good thing and celebrated. It was an outrageous thing. People have been campaigning for so many years about domestic violence against women, men being the outrageous majority of perpetrators. And yet, let's celebrate a sport, the pinnacle of fairness and meritocracy. Let's just watch two biological men smash women on their way up to winning a gold medal. This verse is not about trans issues. I'm just saying that for me is an illustration of the subversion of good and evil. Verse 21. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. Very similar to now when you eat of this fruit, you will be wise. You will be able to discern the knowledge of good and evil. You will be able to decide for yourself, Eve, what is right and wrong. Don't let God tell you what's right and wrong. You could be like God, knowing or deciding good and evil. So woe to those who are wise in their own eyes, clever in their own sight, as opposed to letting God decide what is wise and clever. And then verse 22 and 23, woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks. It's another fun illustration of dedication to alcoholism. Get up early in the morning, not to go to the gym, but to drink. These people are heroes and champions, exalted status. Way, let's celebrate these guys. What are they renowned for? What are they world class at? World champion of drinking wine. World champion at mixing drinks. That's your leaders. And what do those guys do? Verse 23, they also acquit the guilty for a bribe, and they deny justice to the innocent. So utter corruption. And these guys are the leaders. World class at drinking wine, bribery, corruption. So woe, 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 woe. And then we get into the therefores. Here's God's devastation. And it's very brutal. Verse 24. Therefore, just like tongues of fire licks up straw. You can picture the way fire works. It just consumes the dry grass. Just like the way dry grass sinks down in the flames, so God's people's roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. So it's all judgment within metaphor, total destruction, but metaphorical. For they have rejected the law of Yahweh Almighty. They have spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. So a picture, a metaphor of total destruction, fire on straw, fire on dry grass. Verse 25, more literal, therefore Yahweh's anger burns against his people. His hand of punishment, you can picture the hand raised ready to strike. The hand is raised and then he strikes them down. The mountains shake, so think earthquake, so that even the mountains are shaking. The dead bodies are like refuse in the streets. If you need to picture that, think Birmingham, but instead of bin bags spilling out with maggots, think dead bodies, just littered everywhere. No dignity. Often in a situation where there's lots of dead bodies, there's a human response to want to reclaim some sense of dignity for those who have died. There's a sense of wanting to collect the bodies, to honour the dead by burying them. In wars, your fellow soldier goes down, they've been shot dead. Rationally, you should just leave their dead body. They're done. They're dead. But there's a sense of wanting to bring back their body so that their relatives can mourn, so that you can honour your fallen soldier. But here, there's no dignity at all because the dead body's just littered everywhere. Everyone's dead, essentially. There's not enough alive people to bring to order the scattered corpses. So that's what I mean by no dignity. So a brutal picture of judgment, and yet, verse 25, yet for all this, God's anger is not turned away. His hand of punishment is still upraised. He's ready to strike again. And those last two lines, I can't help but think, Christian subculture, modern Christian subculture, probably cannot handle those two lines. We struggle to imagine God as angry anyway. So we struggle to imagine God being this angry, destroying everyone, killing everyone, earthquake, dead bodies everywhere, and yet he's not had enough. He still is more angry, more punishment to come. But God's word is very clear, isn't it? Then over the page, verse 26, here's more devastation. God signals, he lifts up a banner for distant nations to come. He whistles, he summons, a bit like a farmer to their dog. He whistles, he summons them. Come here, distant nations, at the ends of the earth. And then here come those nations, the agents of God's destruction. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. And here's verse 19, cashing out. Israel said, God's got a plan, has he? Let him hurry then, let him hasten his work. Let him be speedy, let us see it. And God's like, you want to see my work coming speedily, do you? Well, here you go, foreign nations coming in swiftly and speedily. I'll give you speedy. And 27 to 30, they are ruthless destroyers. Verse 27, not one of them grows tired or stumbles. There's no respite at all. These are efficient killing machines. Not one slumbers or sleeps. There's nothing wrong with them. Not a single belt is loosened at the waist. Not a single sandal strap is broken. They are ruthless. They are coming. They're going to get you. 28. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows are strung and ready. Ready for action. Their horses' hooves are hard like flint. Their chariot wheels go round and round like a whirlwind. So fast, powerful, inevitable. Verse 29. Their roar is like that of the apex predator, the lion. They roar like young lions. And I really like the visual of the next two lines. They growl as they seize their prey, and then they carry it off with nobody to rescue the prey. So you can picture the lion, the limp prey in mouth. Nobody's going to challenge that lion. They're like, right, he dead. Yeah, we're not going to tackle that lion. And then 30, that continues, in that day, they will roar over their prey like the roaring of the sea. So even if you wanted to come close and rescue the prey, you get the fierce lion roaring, back off, says the lion. That prey is mine. Ruthless destruction. And then the final three lines of verse 30, it ends with the camera zooming out. Now, if one looks at the land from afar, what do you see? Only darkness and distress. Even the sun is darkened by clouds. So there's a vast portrait of Judah's sin and God's wrath. And his wrath is plenty, isn't it? Right. Let's just talk a little bit about function or structure of Isaiah. If you look at the header on the inside of the handout, chapter 1 to 5 summary, the white box on the left, that's where Isaiah is going with all these pictures. I've put all these jarring pictures together so that you, reader, are asking, how can I be spared judgment? How can I be rescued from this broken and cursed world? How can I be spared your anger and judgment day, God? So two senses of judgment that one could be spared from. And then also, how can I live happily ever after? So that is what Isaiah is intending for the reader to be thinking about as you read these pictures. And so if you turn to the back page, I focus that question a bit more. So chapter 5 in light of the whole of 1 to 5. If God feels this way about sin, if he is this angry about sin, this displeased, how can one be spared judgment? How can one live happily ever after? That's a direction of travel that we should be taking with this. It should make us marvel. You know, we obviously know the answer to how God solves a sin problem. It's a Sunday school answer every time. Jesus' death on the cross, that takes away our sin, and that's how it can be that one is spared judgment and one can live happily ever after. Obviously, we also need Jesus to return for eternal life to begin. But we ought to really feel the weight of sin. So if you look at the reflection box, question 2, I think we can often be very complacent or nonplussed about sin. We intellectually acknowledge that we are sinful, but we don't feel the weight of it. We don't grieve it. We don't hate it. And then I think 2b, we also don't therefore appreciate Jesus' death on the cross particularly. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, it's easy for that to be like, I know this. Why are you telling me? That can be our internal attitude. We may be too good at church face to ever say that on a Sunday. But I think it's quite likely that to some extent we feel a sense of complacency or taking Jesus' death on the cross for granted. So that's ultimately, I think, where we want Isaiah 5 to help us in our worldviews. Question 1 is a diagnostic which might help us to deal with God's feelings. So I think there's a common hidden assumption that people have about God, that he's not a person, doesn't have a personality, and therefore doesn't have feelings. And therefore, he's a bit like a... You know, in Star Wars, you have the Force. He's got this sort of impersonal Force, or metaphorically, he's like a cosmic-level vending machine. I just have to put in prayer tokens and outcome good answers to my prayers, like that job interview result or something. But we don't think of God as a person with personality, with character, characteristics, and therefore we just don't permit him to feel anything at all. And yet here, how much of a person is God? Not human, but person, personality.